There's a place in New York where you can walk through the actual front doors of the world's most famous recording studio, Abbey Road. Through those doors, past the Beatles, Pink Floyd, Radiohead, and countless other rock giants. Where can you find those doors? At the Hard Rock Cafe Times Square. The Abbey Road doors and thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock Cafes, Hard Rock Casinos, and Hard Rock Hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Stephen's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
It's coolest conversations time here in Little Stephen's Underground Garage, and this is the Mighty Manfred. Thanks for listening, and please remember to follow, subscribe, rate, and review. Today's interview is an extra special one and the first of a two-parter. I recently had the opportunity to speak with Richard Goddard, songwriter, producer, and music business entrepreneur whose career spans over six decades. In part one, we cover his introduction to rock and roll by disc jockey Alan Freed, his meeting fellow producers and songwriters Bob Feldman and Jerry Goldstein, their work together with the Angels, the three of those gentlemen then becoming the Strange Loves, and also their working as producers with the McCoys. This leads us up to Richard meeting Seymour Stein, with whom he founded Sire Records. To set the stage, let's hear some of that 1963 number one hit that Richard wrote with Bob Feldman and Jerry Goldstein, My Boyfriend's Back, as performed by the Angels. And then I'll be back for part one of my interview with Richard Goddard on your coolest conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Stephen's Underground Garage.
He went away and you hung around and bothered me every night. And I wouldn't go out with you. You said things that weren't very nice.
My boyfriend's back and you're gonna be in trouble.
Hey la, hey la, my boyfriend's back.
See him coming, better cut out on the double.
Hey la, hey la, my boyfriend's back.
You've been spreading lies that I was untrue.
Hey la, hey la, my boyfriend's back.
So look out now, cause he's coming after you.
Here, and it's a big day on your Coolest Conversations podcast in Little Stephen's Underground Garage, because I have the honor of chatting with Richard Goddard, whose career as a songwriter, record producer, and record label executive stretches over six decades. Along with Bob Feldman and Jerry Goldstein in the 60s, he wrote and produced hits for girl groups like the Angels. Then later, the three of them became artists in their own right as the Strange Loves. In the 70s and through the 80s, he produced groups like Blondie, the Go-Go's, Richard Hell and the Fleshtones, Robert Gordon, among others. And in the late 90s, he founded the digital music label The Orchard. He managed and produced the Raveonettes in the 2000s, and there's lots more stuff I didn't mention that I hope will come out as we speak. Hi, Richard. How are you?
Hey, great, Richard. How you doing?
Doing pretty great. Very, very honored to have the chance to talk to you, Sam. I read that you were born in the Bronx. Where are you right now?
I'm in a small village upstate outside of New York City. I'm lucky enough that we have the house in addition to the apartment in the city that we just left over a month ago, just up here, and easy to get food and things from local places. And, you know, we're in the Amazon world. I was just online before you called about to order several more cases of essential water on Amazon Prime.
Well, it seems like you're managing these COVID times pretty well. Have any of your friends or loved ones gotten ill?
No, not that I know of, which is fortunate. It's terrible about anyone getting ill from this, but we've been fortunate in that nobody that I know personally has gotten ill from it.
Oh, thank goodness. So, God, what a career that you've had, you continue to have. When you sold your soul to the devil with this whole rock and roll music thing, did you think he realized how much mileage he was going to get out of you?
Yes, you might be right, sold my soul to the devil. I don't know, because you think about it, what else could you have done in the world, you know, if this didn't come along? But no, I was, when I was a kid, I guess I'm listening 13 or 14, I was one of the ones that were turned on by the legendary great Alan Freed. You know, kid growing up in the Bronx in a middle-class white Jewish family, you know, you don't hear this kind of music. You know, and as a kid, I had a transistor radio and would listen with it under the pillow before I worked for school. I would go to sleep at night and listen to Alan Freed when he was still called Moondog. And his show began with an, oh, it's the Moondog hour, you know. And he had to change the name because he got sued by this blind poet, street person who had copyrighted the name Moondog. And he changed his name, and there came rock and roll. They had to call it something. And I remember this. I mean, there are great moments listening to him that I still remember to this day. If you want, I'll give you two of them. And yeah. One is really poignant, and the other is, you know, there was a record, Hearts of Stone. And you can look it up and see. And in the middle, he goes, kids, first person that calls in and tells me how many times you hear the word no in the center of it, gets blank of surprise. And it was, hearts made of stone, it can never break. I said, no, 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 no. Everybody knows. Well, you know, I counted them out, but I forgot that everybody knows, even though it's not the word no, sounds like no, and that's the extra one. So always remember that. I don't think it was the Jewels. It might have been the Jewels, but Hearts of Stone. And the other one, which is what really kept me in this business that I never forgot, and I think as a reference Paul Simon makes to probably hearing the same thing that night in a song that he wrote, and you don't know what the song is after. So listening to the radio, and you're a kid, 14, 15 years old, maybe, yeah, all of a sudden, the voice of Alan Freed, kids, we're going to stop for a minute and have a moment of silence. Boink, the radio goes dead for 1 minute, okay? And then he goes, Johnny Ace is dead. And you hear, I looked at the clock, the face on the wall. It wasn't yet Pledging My Love, but it was the clock. And it, yeah, comes on, and you hear this ghostly, unearthly voice.
Yeah.
And he goes, Johnny Ace is dead. And Paul Simon wrote a song, I think, called Johnny Ace is Dead on one of his albums. And that stuck with me. And I finished high school, went to college, started a year of law school, but continued writing songs and somehow got into the music business. And that's a moment I never forgot.
Well, you mentioned you continued writing songs, went to law school. When did you first,
I started because when you listen, I was a piano player.
Yeah.
And one of the things I could do better than most kids or most adults at the time was I was into Glenn Miller, Benny Goodman, and Boogie Woogie piano. So I could play, you know, the St. Louis Blues with the crossing left hand and the,
yeah,
and the shuffle beats on my left hand. So Boogie Woogie Piano was an expression in a sense of American blues. And when you hear Al Freed and he's playing rhythm and blues, which is a bit different, but it's still blues based. And that got me really crazy, and I started writing songs. And then along comes, of course, Elvis Presley, and I liked Elvis, but I loved Jerry Lee Lewis because he was, of course, a brilliant piano player and still is. So I started writing songs. You know, I started singing Great Balls of Fire and Breathless, and I guess I was 15 or 16. I wrote a song after Great Balls of Fire called I'm on Fire. And it's funny how things happen, but the apartment in the Bronx was on a street, Sheridan Avenue, but there was a hill going down, and we were on the second floor, but because it was a hill, the window faced directly on street level.
Uh-huh.
So the side window in the living room, and I would sit and I'd play the piano, and the window would be open. And one day somebody sticks their head in and says, hey, kid, that's pretty good. Would you like to make a record? You know, just out of nowhere. And I said, well, I could ask my father. And we met the guy. He turned out to be a songwriter who wrote standards. And my first experience brought me down to 1650 Broadway, where he and his brother had an office and set me up with some people. And I made my first demos. It was kind of crazy because everyone was looking for 16-year-old kids. Nothing changed. You're looking for 16-year-old kids today.
I need to interrupt you for just a second because you're talking about playing the piano and they're at home, but you've also mentioned how you were in this middle-class family, and then this guy sticks his head in, and you have to go ask your father. I mean, what was your family's take on you playing this kind of music, and were they genuinely supportive of what you were up to?
Well, I had to take classical lessons, and I had to practice. I was brought up with the fact that you have to have an education, and you have to be able to do, you know, I was raised by two people that really cared about what my life would become. Not that they wanted me to be a musician, but it was part of your overall education to be study music as well as you study something else. And It's an activity that'll be good for you. And I played classical music, and I took lessons with a swing jazz piano player, but it was the blues that interested me more than anything else. And I guess somewhere in the back of my head, or wherever we all come from, you know, whether we're born again or not, this musical form and the culture and the soul of it really grabbed me. And hearing Alan Freed on the radio just made it real, because you heard real people doing it. And then as a kid, you start thinking, oh, I could do that too. Well, the song I wrote called I'm on Fire, the story goes on into the future, but I wrote it and would imitate Jerry Lewis.
Yeah.
Right. And I guess it must have been after my boyfriend's back. He was on the same label as the Angels were, Smash Records.
Yes, Smash.
He was doing his last rock and roll record before he went country. And we were the hot thing at that time at the convention because we had the number one record. My boyfriend's back.
Right.
So they introduced me to Jerry Lee, and I actually could sit down at the piano and play it for him. And little did I know that he recorded that song as his last rock record, if you want to call it rock, before he went strictly country. So Jerry Lee Lewis did it, and it was used in the film Great Balls of Fire, and it was amazing. I met him once again at some point, and the fact that Jerry Lee Lewis recorded a song that I wrote as a kid was amazing to me.
Very cool closing of the circle there. So you wrote that, you said you were around 15 or 16. So then this gentleman sticks his head in the window and he takes you down to the to his office there. You didn't go straight into songwriting. Then you went off and you said you spent some time in college. Is that where you met Bob Feldman and Jerry Goldstein, or how did you meet those guys?
What happened was I continued on in bits and pieces writing songs, and I got involved, I forget who introduced me now, but so I got involved with a publisher, and he would send me out on song assignments sometimes. And there was one particular artist who was successful in the R&B sense at that time. I was still in college, and it was Gladys Knight and the Pips.
Right.
And I remember that I drove in and went to their basement townhouse in Harlem, and that's about 130-something street, and again, sat down at the piano and played this song for them for their album, and they loved it. They liked the way I played. They thought I had the kind of soul that went with what they were doing, and they recorded this song. It was called Morning, Noon, and Night. It's on one of the early Gladys Knight albums. Obviously, they were great singers, and she was amazing. Mm-hmm. And it was like a thrill. So it was one more thing that encouraged me. Mm-hmm. So as I followed up with this particular publisher, I had an appointment, and I'm waiting there outside his office, and there are two other guys waiting, and we're waiting, and we're waiting. And finally, we looked at each other, talked to him. Well, what do you do? What do you do? Oh, yeah, well, we're a writing team. Bob and Jerry were working together at the time. Uh-huh. And he said, hey, what are you wasting time here for? We have a room somewhere. Let's go and write a song. You know what? That's it. It wasn't more complicated than that. We went and we wrote a song, which I can't even remember what it was. And then we got involved writing songs together. And we would walk from office to office in the Bill Building, 1619 Broadway, and knock on doors. We have a song. You have an artist that you're recording, that kind of thing. And that's pretty much how it was done at the time. And then everyone was looking for young kids, mostly white middle-class kids that had a feeling for what was going on musically. Yeah. And we seemed to have it, yeah. And we got involved with a man named Wes Farrell. He was about our age, but he was a soul plugger. And he brought us down to a company called Roosevelt Music, and they gave us a little room with a piano and said, we'll bring artists in that are coming up for records. You guys write songs for them. So that was it. So we started writing songs, and that's how we met Dion, Bobby V, Freddie Cannon. Even people from Motown came in looking for songs. Over, I don't know why they would have needed it. We wrote a great song for the legendary Jerry Butler called Giving Up on Love. Oh, prior to that, that's how they found out about us. We got involved with a small company called Beltone Records. Mm-hmm. Now, Beltone Records was, I guess I wouldn't call them legendary, but they had one huge, huge hit. There were several, but one huge, huge one. It was Bobby Lewis, Tossin' and Turnin'.
Okay.
So people know that. I'm tossin' and turnin'. Yeah. Well, baby, 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 got me. Yeah. So in our cleverness, we wrote a song called Tossin' and Turnin' Again. So all we did was parody the Tossin' and Turnin', but referred to the year before. And then my baby's got me tossing and turning again. Well, it's our first chart record. The first time we ever heard anything on the radio, it got like to 90, because obviously there was no room for another tossing and turning again. But it got us to continue writing songs for this company.
Yeah.
Now, they had an artist called the Jive Five, who had a classic doo-wop song called My True Story.
Okay.
So it's another one to look up. It's a great doo-wop record.
Right.
We wrote this, which turns out to be a legendary song, called What Time Is It? And it goes on and on about a guy going out on a date, and he keeps asking every few minutes, what time is it? They say, it's 8 o'clock. I'm walking down the street. It's 8 o'clock. I'm at her door. And then, knock, 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 what time is it? And then the big ending, it's time for love. In the background, you're going, tick, tock, listen to the clock, tick, tock. Oh, well, those were the days when you didn't need to have a tremendous multi-million seller record, because you could have a song like this that went number one in Pittsburgh.
Right.
And you could sell in Pittsburgh, nowhere else but Pittsburgh. And then it might sell in Chicago and then somewhere else. So you could actually break a record or a song or something market by market. Not the way it's done today, obviously.
Right.
But it was exciting because different areas of the country had, and probably still have, unique tastes. Radio, you're on radio, stations in different areas might do different things. Some would speed up the track a little bit. Some would compress it a bit more. All to cater to the sound and the culture of the area they're in.
Right.
So the record I might have done that sounds one way and sounded one way in New York City might have sounded completely different in Texas. Well, not that different, but different. So after that, we became sort of recognized. Met Wes, was brought to Roosevelt Music, where we met all these other people, because they would come in and, you got a song? Okay, let me see. What do you feel like singing? Here, how about this? And we just come up with something based upon what they had done prior that we thought they might like.
Right.
That's how we learned to become songwriters. And interestingly, there was no way to make a demo of it. So you had to make a demonstration recording. There were studios in the basement of 1650 and in the building that were hired out by the publishers. They give you a budget to get a few musicians, and you go down to the studio, and make a demo using your ideas of what your song would sound like, or right. should sound like, if we're on a record. And we learned to be producers. It was mono, so everything had to be done. And then I think there was one other track you could overdub on. So you had to plan it out. And to this day, I know Stephen makes his recordings more in this style than the style that's made today, but it's the same thing for me. Even when I got up to multi-track recording and I could use the 32, 64 tracks, I would never keep anything I didn't want to use. I make decisions as I go. A lot of people keep everything and then use them in remixes. I like the idea. Again, this is my good friend Stephen. Stephen Vance, probably the same way. How do you capture that magic moment that hopefully can never be repeated again? You know, you can mix things, sell more product to people, but how do you capture that magic moment? And it comes in the moment. Well, with mono recording, with less multi-track, you have to make decisions. And the moment that you capture is eternal. And those records, for me, live forever. But we're not living in a time where moments live together forever anymore. We're living in an expansive time where everything is available to us.
Everything is available in its expanses, as you said, but that doesn't mean that what you've described already as a magic moment can't make an everlasting impression on somebody. I mean, I still think...
It can make an everlasting impression, but it would be like, I'm not comparing my work to the Mona Lisa, but it would be like saying, well, there's that painting. Why don't we figure out how to add a bit more red to it? You know, I mean, a moment is a moment in time that's magic and great. That never changed. What changed is our perception and our realization that things don't have to be moments anymore, that we could expand almost anything. And then we come to this moment in time and you can't fly anywhere, you can't go anywhere. And all these things we thought we made eternal are not eternal. They're literally, I shouldn't even say not real. I think probably not real. That we're back to a place where you literally might have to grow your own food. So I'm lucky that I lived through those treasured moments and now can see this, not the COVID-19 moment, but the moment when everything is expanded and I can still feel for that magic moment that I had, but still understand that that doesn't last forever and things change. And if you want to grow, you participate in the change. The real value is that I can remember those moments existed and hopefully in the present time find some way to recreate that feeling, you know, and participate in it.
I agree with that. So you would go down into the basement and there were these studios set up and you guys were making demos. You guys working amongst yourselves figured out how to or become producers. When did you actually start being given the opportunity to produce these different artists?
Well, we weren't given the opportunity. That was the thing. We became, quote, independent producers, and as songwriters had the material. At that time, you coming to the right, well, of course, there was great Lieber and Stola. They were the first great, I think, independent producers. Phil Spector had not come along yet, was just about coming along. Of course, Burke Burns was great. And there were the great labels like Atlantic Records, independent labels. It was the smaller independent labels that were encouraging people like us. Because the big labels, the majors, had producers on staff. So we, as kids that wrote the songs, had control of the most valuable element, which was the song. We then had control of the other element because we learned by virtue of making these demos in real studios how to create a sound and environment that would make these things work. So we started looking for artists ourselves that we would write the songs for. During our Roosevelt period, when we were at Roosevelt Music, someone brought in a group of girls. They were called the Angels. They had a pretty big hit record with a ballad called Till. And we sat with them and we wrote a couple of songs. One of them they recorded called I'd Be Good For You. And we all became friends. Yeah. And they were sort of shifting labels at the time. And we said, well, we got an idea for a song. We've just finished it. It's a great story, which we'd like to record with you. And then you sign to our production company, FGG Productions, and we'll place it with a record label, which eventually is what we did. The story of my boyfriend's back is really pretty simple. Bob Fillman was in a coffee shop in Brooklyn, ice cream parlor, soda shop.
Yeah.
He heard some girl yelling at some guy, you know, you're in trouble. You shouldn't have said those things about me. My boyfriend's back. We don't know from where he's back, but my boyfriend's back and he's going to kick the shit at you. You know, something like that. So Fillman comes in and we would all bring ideas in and we'd sit around with a legal yellow pad and a piano in our little room, because at that time we had moved on from Roosevelt and became the first writers signed to April Blackwood, which was CBS, which was eventually purchased by someone else, and then Sony. So it's Sony ATV now. And again, our little room with the songwriting, and we sit down, and we wrote a number of songs for April Blackwood, but in particular, we wrote this one while we were signed there, and went down to our studio in the basement and couldn't get in because they weren't available, and the arranger we wanted wasn't available, so we had to find somebody else. Uh-huh. And we found another studio. The one in the basement of 1650 was called Allegro. The one we went to and recorded my boyfriend's back was called Associated, and they had a couple of, again, young engineer people, and we wrote my boyfriend's back sitting at a piano, rehearsed it with the girls, went into the studio, and at that time, in the three-hour session, you're allowed to cut four songs. So we had several other songs we cut as well, and session was over, and we had the song. And it took time to do the overdubs. You know, we'd become fans of Phil Spector, and, you know, at that time.
Yeah.
And, you know, we saw how he worked, and I guess he saw how we worked. You know, we were sort of contemporaries, and we built a sound around it that turned out to be interesting. The song is, my boyfriend's back, that is, has lived for, approaching 60 years.
Right.
And is now currently most famous as being the Hess truck's back for the last 30-some-odd years. The Hess truck, every time around Christmas, comes back, and now they're selling miniature trucks using the song as a commercial. And it was just re-signed again, and it's going to continue for another 10 years. It's interesting. You know, you never anticipated things like that when you were writing songs at that time. But now that's become mainstay of the song. And everybody seems to know the song. And because that was successful, it led us to other things and other artists. And, oh, so my boyfriend's back. There used to be promotion men that would go around the Brill Building and sort of say, it's like we used to do with our songs. I've heard you kids have done something good. Can you play it for me? And he played for this guy. His name was Doug Moody. And he said, you know, I'm with Mercury Smash Records. Give me a week. Don't show it to anybody else. I'll come back to you with something. Yeah. You know, you don't even think about it. Sure. Sound like a nice guy. Week later, he comes back and says, we want to put this record out. So, well, we got other offers, which we didn't. And what do you want? And we asked for what was a high royalty at the time and a nice size advance, but, you know, something reasonable. They said yes. We mastered the record. Smash Records put it out. 6 weeks later, it's number one.
Right.
It's sort of a remarkable little story.
Absolutely. So you were working with the Angels, and you were young guys at the time. Were you working with other girl groups then as well?
Yeah. At that point, we started working with a lot more girl groups. I'm trying to think, we put together There was one girl called Diane Christian. She was great. There was a group that we put together with another guy we worked with, Robert Spencer. He brought these girls in. They were called Patty Lace and the Petticoats. And there's a classic, really cool record that if you wanted to, you could look it up. It's called Sneaky Sue. And it came out on Cap Records. And, you know, we're sort of in demand, and people started coming after us at that time. And we continued writing songs. But after that, we left because we had money from my boyfriend's back. We left April Blackwood, and we became, funded ourselves, became independent producers, and opened our own publishing companies. And we wrote songs for ourselves then, and we managed ourselves. And as things kept going with the Angels, we did a second record that didn't do as well. It was a song called I Adore Him. Mm-hmm. I Adore Him was written by Jan Berry from Jan and Dean and another fellow, Artie Kornfeld, who I knew. Why we didn't write the follow-up, I don't know. But we didn't. We tried and we couldn't get there. And we thought this was really cool. And we recorded it. It did well, but not nearly as well. We made other records with the Angels. And it was sort of, the relationship was at that time sort of falling apart because producers then were, I like to use the expression, the Phil Spector school. You know, it's like, okay, we're the ones that have the songs. We're the ones that know what to do. You're the artist. What you do is you sing what we tell you, and then we'll let you know when the record's coming out. That doesn't work today anymore, and I would never do that with anybody. But that's the way it was sort of done then, and at least in this community we were in. And so the relationship broke down. And it broke down finally with a song that was a standard at the time, the ska beat, you know, the upbeat rhythm, check, 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 check.
Yeah.
It was the feel of my boy lollipop. Dun, 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 check. It was West Indian ska beat, not reggae, but ska. And so we took a standard song we wanted the girls to do. It was, I think it was Joni Jane's. It's called A Little Love That Slowly Grows and Grows. Not one that comes and goes. That's all I want from you. Well, we did it. A little love that slowly grows and grows, love. Not one that comes and goes, love. So with an upbeat, right?
Yeah.
And in the middle, now this is 1964. And Beatles, Rolling Stones, all these people started picking up on American blues and American music and feeding it back to us. So in the middle, because the girls didn't want to do this, we recorded it ourselves, right? And the three of us, we didn't have a name, and Dr. Strangelove and How I Love the Bomb was a movie of the period.
Right.
So we took the name The Strangelove. Okay, so in the middle, because of the British invasion, Bob Feldman says, I'll do the narration. And he takes a fake English accent and does a little roof roof, that's Lady Grews and Grews. And it was really not very good, but it sounded English. And we go to one of our connections, which was Swan Records, which was a label that was owned by Dick Clark. It was out of Philadelphia. And they licensed the record from us. One of their claims to fame, besides having Freddie Cannon and a few other hits, they also licensed I Think She Loves You. It was on Swan. I think it was She Loves You. But the Beatles were licensed on several different labels
right.
the year before their albums came out.
On VJ.
So Swan was one of them.
Yeah, and Swan.
VJ and Swan. So Swan licensed The Strangelove. With the fake English accent in the middle. Record comes out, nothing's happening. We get a call because we had done some promotion work from a guy in Virginia Beach, Virginia, called Gene Loving. There was a radio station in Virginia Beach, Virginia, and that was sort of a breakout area. And he traveled the country as DJs do and took different positions. And he called us and said, hey, I think I could break this record for you. I said, really? He says, but you got to come down and do a show for me. But you can't just come down, because when people hear this, I'm getting phone calls. They hear the middle section and they think it's British. So I said, well, we can't be British. We'd never fall for it. Well, that's how we became Australian. The Strangeloves became Australian right then and there. We were like stoners at the time. We even had our own posse. We got in two cars, drove down to Virginia. We had never played anywhere, but from the studio, we had borrowed these hanging drums. And it's really true. We had to do several songs for this show in an auditorium. And it was a big auditorium. So we drive down to Virginia Beach, and we pull into the radio station, and he says, well, you guys crazy? You can't come in here. Let me show you. We've got to go out to the airport. So we go out to the airport, and they put us on a prop plane, and it taxis down from one end of the airport to the terminal, where there's like hundreds of screaming kids, those girls, and they got jelly beans and teddy bears, and they're throwing them at us, and there's a sign that says, Virginia Beach, Virginia welcomes Australia's Strangeloves. And we get off, and we do the show. Okay. So we do the show. It becomes a hit in Virginia Beach, but never anywhere else. But during the show, one of the songs we did was a variation of the Bo Diddley beat, because we had to do something. And as a kid, I always loved it. So yeah. I'd be banging on the drums going, boom, 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 boom. And if you can imagine, you're like stoned. You smoked a lot of weed. You got a pretty girl breaking a popper on the side of the stage. And you step it, go running out. You're scared as hell, but high. And you go boom, boom, and you finish. And there's not a sound. I still remember this. There's not a sound. And there's thousands of people in the auditorium. And all of a sudden, it erupts. People are screaming, standing on their feet, because it's the Strangeloves from Australia hitting you with a big beat. And so from there, we go back and we record a version of the Bo Diddley beat. I call it the Bo Diddley beat, but it's the doo 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 doo.
Right. Shaving haircut. Yeah.
But we do it in this huge drum sound, right? So the Strangeloves all of a sudden become, oh, yeah, we'll be honest. At the time, we're hanging out with girls our age, and there's another guy hanging out at the same time. They said, you got to meet. Well, he's quite a bit older, you know, Ahmed Erdogan, who says, you guys are cool. You should come and use my studio.
Right. Well, so, Erdogan, he's the head of Atlantic Records still at that time.
Atlantic Records. Yeah, which was one of the great record labels inviting us to this great Atlantic studio. So I said, whatever you want to do. So what do we want to do? We got this track we made, and we go in, and we use the track, which is different than typical Bo Diddley, but we sing Bo Diddley. And I remember it gets done, and by this time we're like 24. So mm-hmm. I'm still young enough to be impressed by people like Ahmed and, of course, his brother Nestle, and Jerry Wexler. He says, oh my God, this is great. Wait till Jerry hears it. They cut an acetate, bring us in the room, and they're going to play it. He starts to play it for Jerry Wexler, who says, okay, let me hear what these kids got, like that, you know? Yeah. And I don't know, these guys couldn't have been that old, but they seemed old to us. And it comes on, and he goes, yeah. I'm going to get these kids out of here before I fucking kill them. Get them out of here. He starts screaming. And we walk out of the room completely dejected, not knowing what went on. Because you remember, we were successful with My Boyfriend's Back, but a year later, bang, if you don't got another hit record, you're out of business.
Yeah.
You know, but we became strange ones. So we leave. Ahmed comes running after us. He says, no. He's kind of funny sometimes, Jerry. Don't worry about him. Here's what you do. Go and see this guy. And the guy was Burt Burns. He said, we just started a label with him.
This right? is Bang, right?
Bang Records. Right. So go see Burt Burns. He listens to it. He says, man, the track's great. But Jerry don't want to hear, you know, three white Jewish kids singing an R&B song at that time, right? He says, yeah. That's what it is. He says, let's write a song using the track. You know, which makes sense. So at the time, there was a soft porn book, which wasn't very much porn, by the author Terry Sutton, who turns out to be the author of Dr. Strangelove also. The book was called Candy, and it was banned in the United States.
Yeah.
It was kind of crazy at that time. But I want candy, and then tell the story of this girl we wanted. Go into the studio, Bert comes up with that guitar lick in the beginning, which was phenomenal, and is played by a great guitarist named Everett Barksdale. So in those days, you would hire studio musicians,
right.
You know, and we had already made the track ourselves with a house band we had and some other people. And we do I Want Candy. By then, we had learned to make records. It was 4-track, but you could put the music on 2 tracks and bounce back and forth on the other 2. So we made this massive sound that became the Strangelove sound, which was this big I Want Candy. And it comes out on Dang as the first or second record becomes a top 10 record, right?
Right, yeah. I think Billboard, it hit 11. I think maybe it was top 10 in Cashbox.
Well, I don't know. It was number one in a couple of places.
Right.
So we get an opportunity to tour. But, of course, we're terrible. We could do I Want Candy, Time Is On My Side, a couple of other songs. But then you go out on the Dick Clark Caravan. You go out on a couple of other things. So now you have to remember we're back being recognized producers again because we now have a hit with I Want Candy. We go on the road. We drive ourselves. We get a road manager, and we go off and start doing dates. And there are funny things happen at some of them. The 4th song we would do in the show was a song that Burt Burns and Wes Farrell wrote called "My Girl Sleepy" that we changed to fit our arrangement. So we would do that using those big hanging African drums to accentuate the beat even more. And one day we're coming off the stage, and I think it was Dave Clark 5, and they said, "Oh, hey, we have a tape machine, and we tape that. You guys don't mind if we go back to England, when we go back and make that our next single. That is such a cool song." And it was Hang On Sleepy. Well, we decide we were going to put that in the Strangelove album.
Right.
But we couldn't get it out quick enough. So on our next date in Dayton, Ohio, there was a backup band because we needed bands to play the instruments for us. We just did the drums and sang. And the band was called Rick and the Raiders. And people started screaming, "We want Rick, we want Rick." And I thought they were screaming for me, but it wasn't. It was for a guy named Rick Zeringer.
Right.
He changed his name to Rick Derringer. It was brilliant. He was 16 years old, and he played just amazing in the band. So as producers, we went to them and said, "You want to make a record?" The same thing that happened with me. "You want to make a record, kid?" And got to talk to our parents. We went to their house. We had lunch or dinner. 2 days later, they follow us in a caravan with their parents to New York. We had already cut the track to Hang On Sleepy. We put them singing on it and Rick playing the guitar solo and have no idea what to do with it. But as we mixed it, and we had our own process of mixing, and as we mixed it, again, recorded at Bell Sound. Bell Sound was a legendary studio on 54th Street in Manhattan that had a unique sound, you know, because it had big rooms. It was constructed so that you could feel the drums and the orchestrations. And this was important to us. So, okay.
What I've heard is you take it to somehow Burt Burns.
So Burt Burns, he's on vacation with a friend of his, I think it was Audie Butler. But we want to play it for him, but we can't play it for him. We figured he'd be the most likely person. So we found out he's at a place in the Catskills called Grossinger's. It was a big hotel. You know, people would go for like a long weekend or a week, you know, and you'd eat in the dining room and hang out. And it was good, a real Catskill Mountain resort. And we go to the hotel. We crash into the dining room. "You've got to come somewhere. You've got to hear this. We couldn't find a phonograph. Then we found a portable record player that the management of the hotel gave us to use, and got into a room and had brought up an acetate. Because the only way you could play something was, you know, an acetate with a needle on a turntable, and played him Hang On Snoopy for the first time. It was truly a great record. It was a great recording. And he just flipped out and said, I'll be back in New York in 2 days. Let's get together and put it out. And we agreed. We had our second record on Bang, and it was Hang On Snoopy. And that, literally, we started going out on tour again, but it was the Strange Loves tour this time that someone booked for us, and we needed a backup band, and we took Rick and the Raiders, who we changed the name to the McCoys, because there was Paul Revere and the Raiders at the time. Right. And I think by the time we got to the Midwest, the Strangeloves, even though we had two other great songs, Carolyn and then Nighttime, that were going to be hits, not as big as Hang On Snoopy, and people were screaming for the McCoys. They'd go on first, and then people would leave when the Strangeloves came in. And the public is fickle, as we know. Right. And by the time we got off of that Strangeloves tour, the McCoys were number one.
You know, I want to interrupt for a second before we get off the McCoys, because there's a question about one of their songs that I think is really killer, Say Those Magic Words. It's a later McCoy single. And on that, the writing credit is shared by yourself, Bob Feldman, Jerry Goldstein, and also Doc Pomus and Mort Schumann. And there's this UK band, an English band, The Byrds, that feature Ron Wood on guitar. They also cover that song, and I'm not sure which version actually came out first. Do you recall that song,
the McCoys? I'm guessing it was the McCoys, because at that time, the British bands would still look to the, quote, Brill Building, 1619. Doc and Mort Schumann worked out of, I think, out of 1619 Broadway on Hill and Range songs they wrote for. That, I'm trying to remember the process of how that was written. But, yeah, it was written as a collective. I think Jerry spent more time with them than I did. That's interesting. I didn't know about the English record. I wonder who that band was.
Yeah, it's Ron Wood's first band. He was also the primary songwriter. They only did about 4 or 5 singles, because the U.S. Byrds then, their records started getting airplay in the UK, and, you know, the English Byrds were kind of swamped by that. But I highly recommend those English Byrds, B-I-R-D-S, Ron Wood's the guitar player on
but
it.
But actually, that's interesting. I never thought about that. I had forgotten about that song. I guess it's still in our catalog, Grand Canyon, so I'll look for it. Yeah, that's interesting. No, we did a number of really good, the follow-up to Hang On Snoopy, we did a Snoopy-ized version of the great song Fever.
Yeah.
You know, that got, like, I thought, the number two. And I have not met him yet, but Bert had become friends with Tony Calder and Andrew Lou Goldham.
Yeah.
And because Bert had made the journey across to the UK and worked with Van Morrison, and because he was such a great R&B songwriter, all the British soul bands and people like the Stones really admired him. So at that time, you, as an American record company, an independent, which Bang was, you would license your material song by song almost outside of the United States, globally. That's how the McCoys and Strangeloves came out on Media, which was a label owned by Tony Calder and Andrew Lou Goldham.
Yeah.
The Strangeloves didn't become that big of a hit in the UK, but the McCoys did. That song, Hang On Snoopy, was a huge hit for Media. And the international business itself was a lot different then. I had not experienced it, hadn't been overseas by then. And let's see, we did a lot of other things with FGG. We continued writing songs, but those are the really big ones.
Yeah.
And it was during the Hang On Snoopy period that Burt Burns engaged the company also engaged an independent promotion man that I met at the time who understood some of the realities of how things needed to be promoted and shortlisted, and that's how I met Seymour Stein.
Yeah.
And I met him through Hang On Sloopy at first, and then we became friends. And after a while, I guess wanted to go on to other things. All of us, Bob, Jerry, and myself. Jerry wanted to move to California, and he did very well with War, you know, and Bob went on to other things. Seymour and I decided to start a partnership and start a production company. So Sire was born.
And with Richard telling us that Sire Records was born, we end part one of our Coolest Conversations. I Want Candy from the Strangeloves, their biggest hits. It went to number 11 on the Hot 100 in 1965. Thanks to Olivia Callahan for producing our podcast. And join me next week for part two, where we hear about Sire Records' early years, Richard's return to producing by working with many seminal new wave and punk bands of the 70s and 80s, and the founding of the music entertainment company The Orchard. That's your next week's Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
There's a place in New York where you can walk through the actual front doors of the world's most famous recording studio, Abbey Road. Through those doors, past the Beatles, Pink Floyd, Radiohead, and countless other rock giants. Where can you find those doors? At the Hard Rock Cafe Times Square. The Abbey Road doors and thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock Cafes, Hard Rock Casinos, and Hard Rock Hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.